This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston is likely to have its first open mayoral seat since 2013. That's because Marty Walsh is expected to be confirmed as president-elect Joe Biden's labor secretary early in Biden's term. Now, Boston City Councilors Michelle Wu and Andrea Campbell had declared their candidacies for the job months ago. They could soon, though, have a lot of company. Stephanie Murray, author of the Political Massachusetts Playbook and co-host of the Horse Race podcast, is following the machinations as a field of candidates slowly starts to emerge. She joins us now. Stephanie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, it's so great to speak with you.
So, Stephanie, this news that became official about Marty Walsh on Thursday, give me one word or phrase that kind of describes what happened next over the weekend.
Earthquake. I'm going to use a few more words, but this is really a once-in-a-decade opportunity for a lot of ambitious politicians in Boston, a city with not a lot of turnover, to become the next mayor.
So you said you were going to use a lot of words. What are some of the others?
It's hard to underscore how big of a deal this is. It's a big deal that Mayor Walsh is headed to the Biden administration to serve as labor secretary, as long as he's confirmed he's the nominee right now. But this mayor's race has the chance to completely reshape the leadership of the city. Boston's always been led by a white man since the city began. And right now, the two candidates who are in the race are both women of color.
Referring, of course, to Michelle Wu and Andrea Campbell, both of whom we've had on the show, as they declared. Who else are you hearing is poised to jump in?
Well, I have my eye on City Council President Kim Janey, who will become the acting mayor of the city and become Boston's first black mayor, Boston's first woman mayor. If she decides to run for a full term, she'll have sort of a leg up. This is a similar situation as how the former, the late mayor Tom Menino rose to power. He was the city council president. Ray Flynn, who was the mayor then, was appointed U.S. ambassador to the Holy See by President Bill Clinton. Menino ran for a full term after he was elevated to acting mayor, and he stayed in power for two decades. So I have my eye on her. I'm not sure if she'll run for a full term. The other person that everyone is buzzing about today is the Boston Police Commissioner, who's kind of teasing that he's looking at a run. He's not totally decided, but, people close to him are saying that he's 95% sure he's going to jump in. And then some others on my short list are Boston City Councilor Anissa Asabi George, her fellow councilors Ed Flynn, Michael Flaherty, Ricardo Arroyo, of all, their names have been out there making phone calls. State Senators Nick Collins and Song Yuching Diaz, John Santiago, a state representative, Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins. You're listening to me make this list.
Right.
It's a lot of people, and the race is shaping up to be crowded. You could see a dozen people get in and try to run for mayor.
So, we saw a very crowded field in the congressional race to replace Joe Kennedy. And obviously, ultimately, Jake Auchincloss won that seat. He ran against, he was a progressive or a self-claimed progressive. Many observers argued he was less progressive than a whole passel of other people also running. You've got a couple of different lanes kind of obviously being occupied, Stephanie, by the list of names you're giving. Two people from law enforcement, many Boston City councilors, for example. Any thought about how likely it is that each of those lanes really will be crowded, or are people going to kind of sniff this out, see who's really serious, and then many of the prospects won't actually wind up jumping in?
That's the big question that we're all looking at and kind of waiting to see what happens. Senator Elizabeth Warren endorsed Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu, who's been running for mayor for a few months now. She did that over the weekend. Perhaps, a sign that this race is already underway and to, shore up support. Andrea Campbell, already in the race, is, saying that she's gaining momentum, touting her fundraising. So it seems like they're trying to kind of show that the race has formed. But on the other hand, like you said, with a crowded race like this, you can win the election with a pretty small share of the vote. You could get 15 to 20% of voters in Boston voting for you and end up being the next mayor. So when it comes to kind of these particular issues, police reform or no police reform, a law enforcement candidate versus someone who's advocating for changes to the police department, shore up different bases around the city. Those types of issues could really form the race in a way that they wouldn't if there were fewer candidates. The other thing to keep your eye on is kind of the ground game in the neighborhoods. Like, as we're seeing people get in, you've got to look at where their support is, how big those neighborhoods are, how big of a name they are, because that'll really shape this race. Even in the pandemic, the ground game is going to be essential.
So I want to ask you timing on all of this. I know that that one big number or date, excuse me, is March 5th, because if Mayor Marty Walsh is confirmed to his new appointment before March 5th, the calendar unfolds differently than if afterward. Can you talk a little more about that?
That's right. And this is a little bit unusual. So if the mayor's race goes to a special election, my guess is that it would benefit Michelle Wu and Andrea Campbell because they've already raised about $500,000 each. They've been in the race. They've got some endorsements. They're not starting from square one like some of these other candidates. On the other hand, if the election goes kind of the way it was planned to be in September, no special election, I think it would probably benefit Kim Janey if she decides to run for a full term, because she'll have kind of a longer runway as the incumbent. Another mechanism to change this would be if it was supposed to go to a special election, the city council could, you know, send a home rule petition to the state legislature and get them to change it to have the election go without a special election. But kind of adding to the confusion there is that it's still a pandemic. We have a brand new speaker in the state house. It's not clear to me that committee assignments and committees will be fully formed in time for something like that to happen. So there, all of these moving pieces are not quite in place just yet.
So it's interesting, Stephanie, in listening to you, there's so much motion, but we really are still at one giant watch this space. Do you have some sense of when you think we're going to shake out with a little more clarity? Is that a couple weeks off? Is it a couple months off? When do you think we're going to start to really have a sense for the contours of this race?
I think that it's going to come in the next several weeks. To give you a sense of how quickly people got in motion, you know, my excellent Politico colleagues in D.C. scooped this news that Mayor Walsh was headed to the Biden administration in the afternoon. And by that evening, potential candidates were gathering in their living rooms around Boston with their allies and talking on the phone. All of this just kicked into gear really quickly. And it has to, because if a special election is coming, you've got to get together, raise your money, do your stuff. Time is kind of the essence. And even for an election in September, we're already halfway through January. Like, it's coming up. So I think this will all continue to be in high gear for the next couple of weeks.
Well, we will keep watching it. That's Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook and co-host of the Horse Race podcast, which follows Massachusetts politics, policy, and elections. Stephanie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So as we just said, lots of unknowns about what will happen next in the mayor's office in Boston. But it seems almost certain that City Council President Kim Janey will become the next mayor of Boston. And she would be the first woman and the first person of color in the role. She would also be the first mother, as former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift points out in WBUR's Cognoscenti today. Swift was at one point the highest profile working mother in the country. She reflects on that experience in her piece, which is called "With Mayor Kim Janey, Boston Media Would Have This Rare Chance, a Do-Over." And she also joins us to talk about it. Governor Swift, welcome back.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
So let's just do a second of horse race here, because I know you heard at least part of what Stephanie Murray was talking about there. What are you thinking as you watch all the hullabaloo over the beginning of this mayoral race?
Well, you know, open races are a great opportunity, and certainly a special election creates even more of an opportunity for lots of folks to flex their political ambition. The landscape in Boston has changed dramatically. Just look at the complexion of the city council, which now has more women and more people of color than we've ever seen in history. And that seems destined to result in not only a large field, but a very diverse field. And I think that's fantastic.
So I want to go back now to the year 2000. I was not yet a mother, but I would be less than 2 years later. And I remember watching events unfold. President George W. Bush nominated Governor Paul Cellucci to be his ambassador to Canada. You became acting governor. You were expecting And you became the first woman to serve as governor in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. All of that was so on your mind that as this unfolded and it became clear that Kim Janey is likely to be acting mayor of Boston, you wanted to write about it. Tell me why.
Well, so, you know, it's very bad politics to talk out and speak out about sexism when it's directed at you. And I was told that very often, and it was very true. Right? You don't want to sound like you're whining. There's no crying in baseball or in politics. But one of the things that I promised myself, particularly as a mother of three daughters, and I think you've heard some of this referred to from the vice president-elect, is that, you know, you do have an obligation to do the job well while you're in it, but then hopefully make it easier for those who come behind you. And one way you can do that is that when you're out of office, you can speak up. And there are so many parallels between the city council president as she prepares to take office. And I'm just struck, right? It's almost exactly 20 years later, and she is going to be an unelected, first-time historic person in a very powerful role in the middle of multiple crises. She needs the power of the office and the, frankly, press to treat her the same way they treated Mayor Menino when he took over as the mayor under similar circumstances.
So it strikes me, Governor, that it's not just the media, and I'm not deflecting simply because I am media, but I remember that time. It was our full public discourse, whether it was in book groups or at the water cooler, et cetera. What are you hoping to make better or help make better for a Kim Janey?
Well, I do think that we have progressed as a country, and you're right. The media are a reflection of what's going on in society. I was in the Title IX generation. I was in high school when Title IX passed. And one of the things I commented today on Twitter in the reaction to my column was that when a lot of sexism in the coverage of me, when people would talk about my appearance instead of my policies, when people were so interested in my husband and what his role would be instead of what my tax policy was. It made me appreciate my parents and how they had raised me to believe that I could do anything I wanted to do. I think that's increasingly becoming true and is not just true in the households where parents believe it, but we have to make it increasingly true in our Commonwealth. But I don't want to totally let the press off the hook, because while it's true that they're a mirror for what folks may be talking about, I think we have learned over the past weeks that when the press chooses to focus on certain narratives, it gives voice to and brings attention to certain storylines that don't help our elected officials to govern, or in fact can minimize their ability to govern effectively.
So stop focusing on the artifacts of the person's family, for example, and more on their policy proposals.
Well, I think, first of all, let's apply the rules the same if we have a female or a male in the office. I can't imagine anybody asks Charlie Baker, you know, how his wife feels about being at home with her children if they were little. I know for a fact that when I was governor and gave birth, that just a few weeks before that, the governor of Rhode Island had had to take a fairly long break from his duties and in fact chose to go to Florida to have prostate surgery. And people were not up in arms. But when I took a few weeks off to give birth to my children, you would have thought we were in a full-blown constitutional crisis, when in fact lots of 30-year-old women have to juggle work and family at that point in their lives.
Governor Swift, what is better now already? I mean, here we have Kim Janey preparing potentially to be the next mayor of Boston. We have Vice President Kamala Harris preparing to come into office. We are in a different time. You've noticed it's 20 years. In our last half a minute or so, what is better already?
So I think, first of all, there are more role models for the city council president to look to. It's hard to be first. I think that Kim Janey will find it, I hope, very reassuring that there is a female person of color as her vice president. And so not being the only, she'll find community and places that she can go to for advice, both private and, I hope, when she needs to, more publicly. And that in and of itself makes a big difference.
That is former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. And we will have a link to her piece in Cognoscenti called With Mayor Kim Janey, Boston Media Would Have This Rare Chance, a Do-Over. It'll be on our website at radioboston.org. Governor Swift, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
More Boston Public School students will be able to return to in-person learning. And that's what we're going to talk about next. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Now, after locking horns for months, the Boston superintendent and the teachers union announced an agreement just this afternoon to bring students back in phases starting February 1st. WBUR education reporter Carrie Young has been digging into the plan. Carrie joins us now. Hey, Carrie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. So this sort of starts with some phases. Why don't you give us the broad outlines of the plan and its phases?
Yeah, so beginning February 1st, so within a couple weeks, students who've been qualified for high in-person priority will be allowed to go back. And so that's students with a different level of disability. There's also students who might be experiencing homelessness are included in that level, as well as more students who are English learners. Then come March, there'll be a lot more phasing in going on. Beginning on the 4th, students in preschool through grade 3 will be heading back. March 18th, that expands to grades 4 to 8. And then by the end of the month, March 29th and April 1st, students in high school, so 9 through 12, will be allowed to head back into the buildings, according to the plan. Superintendent Brenda Caselia said on a call with the media today that this plan really is good news for families and really the rest of the school community who had been hoping for an in-person learning return this year.
That will give us stability in turning this new year. It will give us certainty for our teachers to feel that they'll have these safety provisions in place, and also give more comfort to the Boston Health Commission that we're able to deliver on those things. And so it took us some time to get there, but we're glad that we were able to get there.
And one important thing to note from what Superintendent Caselia said just there is that that the plan gives parents some stability. So the agreement that the district made with the teachers union, there isn't a hard and fast metric that would lead schools to close their doors again. City officials say they are considering education to be one of the most essential services they can provide right now, so they're really making it a priority to help keep those school buildings open. And to do that, they are working really hard to provide students and especially staff with the safety provisions to make that happen.
So, Carrie, depending on the number you look at, our coronavirus statistics right now rival or in some places exceed where we were back in the spring when schools shut down. So what is Boston doing, or how is the district going to keep students, teachers, and staff safe with this reopening?
Yeah, I mean, safety precautions have been a big part of this agreement, and it's been a big part of the disagreements in the past. So some of the biggest safety precautions that were included in this particular agreement were the addition of standalone ventilation units for classrooms and really in those buildings with the older infrastructure. The district's also even planning to log and then report those air quality readings just sort of as a backup. And then the other big thing here is regular surveillance testing for all teachers in all 125 Boston public schools. And sort of on another note that you alluded to earlier, you know, when it comes to our coronavirus infection rates, Boston Public Health Commissioner Marty Martinez mentioned today that, you know, while the infection rate numbers are up and even higher than in past surges, that hospitals in the area right now, according to him, are not as strained, at least, as they were last spring in the first surge, which is an important difference, especially when it comes to their decision-making for reopening schools.
Carrie, we noted at the beginning here that this was a plan announced by the teachers union and the Boston Public Schools. That has not been easy to get to. What have been the major sticking points in negotiations?
Yeah, I mean, you remember that vote of no confidence back in December from the teachers union just after the district announced an expansion of in-person learning for more high-needs students. So then, and really all through this negotiating process, it seemed the sticking points had to do with access for regular surveillance COVID testing for teachers and how often that happened. So the district says that they are, expanding that regular testing to all teachers now, and they're even working on more ways to expand testing for students. And very importantly, this was something that was brought up to me several times, too, is that this agreement is in writing and that it covers all 125 Boston public schools. So it's an individual memorandum of understanding, which is really something that the union had been pushing for.
So let's jump to testing capacity. How is that expansion happening?
Yeah, I mean, one, from my understanding, the Boston city programs that they are already releasing for, you know, any Boston resident is how they'll be covering the teachers and students here. So the Boston Public Health Commission has been working pretty hard to expand their capability of handling more demand potentially as students open. And so that's what officials were saying it took a little bit longer to actually be able to announce this. They just wanted to make sure they could actually do what they were promising.
Carrie, I guess I should clarify. I know this might seem obvious, but just to be sure, students do not have to go back into hybrid learning, correct?
That's correct. So students don't have to go back. It's all optional. And the district has not gotten firm numbers on how many students are planning on coming back for hybrid learning, but their estimate is that around half might take them up on that.
All right. Now, I know this is just out this afternoon, but have you heard reactions, criticism, responses so far, anything?
Well, I mean, mostly I've heard from the union, and so far that's been pretty positive. Boston Teachers Union President Jessica Tang pointed out today that one of the big reasons, again, her organization is so on board is that it's in writing and it covers all of their schools, which is a lot more than other large districts are doing around the country, the big one being Chicago. And that district is seeing some significant tensions with their educators right now as they attempt to reopen buildings. It's something that Jessica Tang addressed today in a media call.
First of all, we have an agreement, and we actually have more than one agreement. And unfortunately, in Chicago, they don't have an agreement at all in writing. And so that's why, I am grateful that we've been able to work with the leadership here in the city to have not just one agreement, but a series that have adapted to our changing and progressing understanding of the pandemic.
And Tang even went a little bit farther today and said that this agreement could be used as a template for other large urban districts around the country. So it seems that the union is pretty heavily in favor of what was agreed upon here today.
All right. And Carrie, just in the last few seconds, what are you going to watch for now?
Yeah, I mean, I think I will be looking out for those numbers of just how many students return to hybrid learning in Boston public schools, where they're coming from, what their backgrounds are, and that kind of thing. Basically watching the rollout process. I think it'll be interesting.
All right. That's WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
Thank you.
A growing number of people are being charged for the roles they played in the assault on the U.S. Capitol last week, including several people from New England. U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Andrew Lelling has said he will prosecute any Massachusetts residents who traveled to Washington, D.C. with the intent to commit violence. WBUR's Deborah Becker has been following the story and the people involved in last week's events. She joins us now. Deb, welcome back.
Thank you. Hello.
So you've been reporting on this since things went down last week. What have you learned about the people from New England who went to Washington for Wednesday?
Well, it appears that there were several busloads, Tiziana, from New England to the nation's capital. Social media posts show various buses going from cities such as Newton, Plymouth, New Bedford, Springfield, communities in New Hampshire. And we do know that one man from Massachusetts, 33-year-old David Ross of Pittsfield, was arrested and charged with unlawful entry and with violating the curfew that was imposed Wednesday night after the violence erupted. There were also dozens of people posting about their participation online. One woman, Diana Ploss, who's a former radio host who has organized several pro-Trump rallies in Massachusetts, posted videos about being there. Here's a clip of a video that she posted during the chaos outside the Capitol, saying that Capitol Police were attacking her and others. Let's listen.
They're attacking us. Can't breathe. Eyes are burning. I'm okay. Don't be worried.
The sound from her and the sound in the background are both striking, Deb. I should note that Diana Ploss appeared on this show around the 2016 election. As you said, she subsequently had her own radio show before being fired from it for an English-only rant that she engaged in. So what have been some of the challenges to tracking down and identifying people, Deb, who went to Washington and the roles that they played there?
Well, we've been trying to track people down mostly through their posts on social media or what they've written on various websites. And those who we have reached out to have not commented. Some said they didn't want to talk to the media. One man refused to talk with WBUR specifically. And now I think that it's clear, these days later, that it's clear that there are significant consequences and that people died in the violence. I don't expect that you'll see too many people speaking publicly. A woman who is a member of the Affordable Housing Trust in Somerville was posting about being in D.C. Wednesday. The account that she was using no longer exists. Her name is Jessica Turner, and she did say she was there, but said she did not go inside the Capitol. But Somerville officials are investigating, and Mayor Joe Curtatone issued a statement saying, quote, "The city of Somerville is duty-bound to investigate, verify, and follow the law and city process when addressing concerns about the conduct of a board or commission member, as we would an employee." He says that process will get underway immediately. And in Natick, the town has received a petition calling for the removal of town meeting member Suzanne Ayani, who also posted online about being in D.C. Wednesday. Natick officials say they will issue a public statement on that later this week, and law enforcement is now investigating. And in Troy, New Hampshire, the police chief there, David Ellis, also posted about being in Washington. He said he was not involved with storming the Capitol, and he condemned the violence, but many are calling for his resignation, and the New Hampshire Democratic Party is among them. Ellis has not commented.
And now some new developments in that story involving Ellis, I believe, the police chief in Troy, New Hampshire. Deb, the town hall is actually limiting people from entering because of threats?
That's right. As of this morning, officials in Troy, New Hampshire say they received dozens of threats, some warning of physical harm because of Chief Ellis's participation in the violent storming of the Capitol on Wednesday. So right now, the town is only allowing people in the town hall by appointment only. And Dick Thaxton, who's chair of the select board in Troy, says regardless, he stands by the chief. Let's listen.
He went to a presumably intentionally peaceful demonstration sponsored by the President of the United States, and a group of other people who apparently were participants in it went and raided the United States Capitol, which is appalling and terrible, but that doesn't involve our chief.
And Thaxton says Troy officials are looking into their options and possible legal action against those who have threatened the town officials.
So let's focus on those who participated in the violence in D.C. Deb, what consequences do they face, both legally and otherwise? I know that U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Andrew Lelling has said he will prosecute Massachusetts residents who participated and stormed the Capitol.
That's right. Legal experts say that those involved could face a variety of criminal charges. Some have already been charged with unlawful entry, violating curfew, but there could be charges related to the five deaths because of the violence, including the death of a Capitol Police officer. There's also been discussion about whether the participants could be charged with sedition, but no one has been charged with that as yet. The U.S. Attorney for D.C. and the FBI are in charge of making those kinds of decisions. And aside from legally, people have already lost their jobs. UMass Memorial Healthcare in Worcester said an employee who posted on social media about being in D.C. last week, is no longer working there. The hospital system also says it's investigating if other employees were there, which of course raises all sorts of questions about when an employer can fire someone, or is the fact that someone was in D.C. enough to terminate them from a job. So I expect we'll be hearing about those issues and more for quite some time to come.
There is a lot to follow here. Deb, thanks for joining us and giving us an update. That's WBUR's Deborah Becker. Again, thanks.
You're welcome.
Law enforcement is tracking down and arresting extremists who participated in last week's violence. And today, new articles of impeachment to remove President Trump from office. And that, with a fight over them, again breaking largely down across party lines. Now, with all that we've seen transpire over the last week, we want to ask you, how has the relationship between the GOP and the country, the Commonwealth, changed? Do you support the congressional delegation, the Massachusetts delegation, all of whom seek to remove the president from office before January 20th? How are you feeling about protesters from last Wednesday, those who stormed the Capitol? How are you feeling about the fact that people who may or may not have been involved in the violence itself are losing jobs, are being called out? What should happen next and why? And what will be the relationship between the GOP and our democracy in the future? Call us about all of it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two guests that were with us last week before all of this happened, and we brought them back together now. Retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst, and WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Judge Gertner, Anthony, welcome back to the show.
Good to be on.
Nice to be here.
So I'm actually going to start by asking you each the same question. Anthony, I'll start with you. Just reactions to what you just heard from Deb Becker's reporting there.
You mean in terms of the folks who participated there? Well, I mean,
yes.
You know, I think there's a legal process that has to play out. And clearly some people there were protesting. A lot of those people broke in and participated in what was essentially an illegal entry into the Capitol and intimidated people, and those people should be brought to justice. And it seems like that effort is at least beginning.
And Judge Gertner, you heard at the end there Deb Becker raising some of the questions that are coming up about the difference between being in Washington, even protesting that day, and being a member of the violence or storming the Capitol building or being inside the Capitol building. What just react to that? Are we being clear about the differences there sufficiently? And are you watching things unfold the way you think they should in terms of consequences?
Well, I think that we should be clear about it. You know, sedition is a very particular kind of charge, which is conspiring to overthrow the government of the U.S., to levy war against the federal government, or oppose the federal government's authority by force. Arguably, that applies to the people who were storming the Capitol, across the threshold of the Capitol, whose purpose, it appears at least, was to stop the electoral count. That, it seems to me, is action and moves directly to what we characterize as sedition. To extend it more broadly to people on the street, to people who went to Washington for a demonstration, has profound risks. Do you recall that just after Labor Day, Barr urged federal prosecutors to pursue seditious conspiracy cases against Black Lives Matter protesters? And we have a long and troubling history with the use of that. So I think that we do have to figure out who was doing what, and when they crossed the threshold into the Capitol, and when their intent, it appears, was to block the vote. You don't get more seditious than that. That's not just standing on the sidewalk railing about it. So I do think we have
Anthony,
to make these distinctions.
So, Anthony, because of the sedition piece in part, we now have our Massachusetts congressional delegation is part of a larger group of people who are pushing for impeachment. Articles being brought forward today, the potential of a vote, as I'm reading, as things are flying by as the day unfolds, potentially Wednesday. Who is leading the impeachment push, and what is the latest?
All right. Well, I mean, the latest is there's one article of impeachment that's been introduced by Congressman Cicilline of Rhode Island, along with Ted Lieu of California, and Congressman Rankin and Jerry Nadler as well. Now, it's been signed on to by lots of other folks, but they're the folks who are introducing this one article of impeachment. And it's a very tight article. It's four pages, and I can just go through quickly some of the highlights. Donald John Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting violence against the government of the United States. It reads, it refers to January 6, 2021, and that's last Wednesday when that insurrection took place. And it says, in the months preceding the joint session, President Trump repeatedly issued false statements asserting that the presidential election results were the product of widespread fraud and should not be accepted by the American people. And then it goes on to talk about how he incited the crowd last Wednesday. Thus incited by President Trump, members of the crowd, article reads, unlawfully breached and vandalized the Capitol, injured and killed law enforcement personnel, menaced members of Congress, the vice president, and congressional personnel, and engaged in other violent, deadly, destructive, and seditious acts. And finally, Tiziana, it says, in all this, President Trump gravely endangered the security of the United States and its institutions of government, demonstrated that he will remain a threat to national security, democracy, and the Constitution if allowed to remain in office. And that pretty much sums it up. And so the Democrats have the votes to pass this. What they tried to do today was essentially to pass a measure that would have called on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove the president from power. Republicans managed to block that today. That means Democrats will vote on it tomorrow. It will pass. And so if Pence doesn't comply, and so far he's indicated that he will not, the Democrats will vote on the article of impeachment on Wednesday. And again, it appears they have the votes to pass it.
You know, Anthony, we haven't done this many times in history, and I'm just so used to hearing the phrase articles of impeachment. I'm glad that you're correcting there. We got to learn to say article of impeachment here. Just briefly, and then I'm going to go to the phones because I think we've got some stuff for Judge Gertner to respond to. But briefly, is it correct that the entire Massachusetts congressional delegation supports taking steps to remove President Trump from office before January 20th?
Yeah, they're all on the record that President Trump should be impeached and or removed from office. So that's clear. And of course, I mean, we can talk about this. Once the House passes the article of impeachment, then it goes to the Senate. And that is and the House has to decide when it will transmit that article of impeachment to the Senate. And if it does it right away, it's not clear that the Senate could do it right away. And then there's a little bit of a sort of back and forth among the Democrats about whether or not this will serve Joe Biden, the incoming president's agenda, in terms of it distracting from his effort to get his people confirmed and pass his agenda. So that leads to a conversation. Well, maybe the Democrats want to wait and transmit the article of impeachment later to give Biden a chance to do that. But there's some back and forth and some disagreement in there as well. So a lot of uncertainty at this point. And it's got to be pointed out, although there's a lot of commitment among Democrats to get Trump out of office, Trump has shown, as we know, an ability to, thwart the will of certainly the House. I mean, this would be the second time he was impeached. It's not at all clear to me they could prevail this second time either to actually impeach him, largely because of Republican resistance.
Judge Gertner, I do want to go to the phones, but very briefly, in follow-up to what Anthony just said, just so I'm clear from a legal standpoint, can the House transmit the article of impeachment to the U.S. Senate and proceed with the process in the Senate when Donald Trump is no longer the president? So after some date after January 20th.
The Constitution doesn't say anything specifically about that, but most scholars believe that they can. At that point, the articles of the Constitution says there are two ways to deal with impeachment. One is to impeach and remove him from office by a two-thirds vote of the Senate, but the other would be to disqualify him from any future positions, which is only a majority of the Senate. There's no reason why the latter could not be done after Trump leaves. No reason why
okay.
It could not. There's no bar to it.
Okay. I have a question, Tiziana, if I could just throw, can I just throw this at for Judge Gertner? Because I think I'm really intrigued about this, and that is the idea of invoking, and I was just reading about this earlier today, invoking Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which, if I have it understood correctly, it says that anybody who was called for an insurrection against the federal government can't run for office.
Right.
Judge Gertner, is that a tactic? Yeah, is that a thing?
is that a thing?
Yeah, no, they could. I mean, the question is how that would be done. In other words, when he announces him, the Congress couldn't proactively say, by the way, it would be essentially an advisory opinion saying, by the way, you're disqualified from now going forward. But were he to go and get papers to run again, that could be invoked. That surely could be invoked.
Let's go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We've got Dave on the line in Concord. Dave, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious if there's a reason why the media keeps calling the people who were in the Capitol last Wednesday as protesters. I mean, they were a mob of violent people intentionally doing harm and trying to do violence in the Capitol. I would describe them as rioters and not protesters, and I'm wondering why the media keeps calling them protesters.
So, Dave, I'm gonna grab one other call here, and then we'll go back to Judge Gertner and Anthony to get those questions answered. Lexi is on the line from Wilmington. Lexi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I called in with a comment, but now it's turned into a question. So I'm fully on board and understand prosecuting people based on criminal activity, but I'm wondering if there's any precedent for employers actually firing people for being at this event. It's not an event, at the riot. And I'm just kind of concerned because I don't know what sort of slippery slope that would present in the future.
All right. So just wondering
what your thoughts are on that, Judge, and I'll take the comments off the phone and on the air.
Great. So two related questions, I think. Anthony, let's start with, you know, how people are talking about it. Dave's question.
Yeah, no, I think Dave raises a great question. I know we got guidance from editorial leadership at NPR about how to refer to these folks last Wednesday, because I think for the first sort of few hours of this event that shocked us all, we were all sort of saying protests, people who are engaged in rowdy activity. And NPR very quickly settled on the term a mob of Trump extremists. I mean, the caller's right. These weren't just mere protesters. I mean, there was a lot more going on. And as the days and hours went by, we learned that this was also planned for days and days on social media. This was an organized effort to, as Judge Gertner just said, to disrupt the counting of the electoral votes and disrupt democracy in action. It was a lot more than a protest. It was
although an act Anthony, of sedition. Judge Gertner did say earlier, we know that at least by some of them it was. We do not know that every person who went to Washington on Wednesday intended to disrupt
the election. No, that's clear. But I think we're talking about those, really unsettling and images of the violent breach of the Capitol that we saw.
That went way past
protesting, and was violent action by a mob of extremists. So anyway, we've been pretty careful about that language, and I take to heart the caller's concern.
I second that. And Judge Gertner, what about Lexi's question about precedent that, you know, around firing of employees that one is aware were in D.C., for example, or firing of employees who stormed the U.S. Capitol in an insurrection?
Private employers, who don't wear, there's no contract of employment that protects you from, you know, when you can be fired, have pretty free rein to fire people who were inside the Capitol, who were threatening to go inside the Capitol, people who were outside. If you have a contract of employment that says there has to be just cause, that would be one thing. Or if you have, you know, you're in public employment and there are procedures for, you know, to protect employment, that would be one thing. But most of us walk around as what's called employees at will, which means you can be fired for good reason or bad reason or any reason at all. So there's really not a lot of protections for people under these circumstances if they don't have an employment contract or a union.
So, Anthony, let's come back here to the Commonwealth now, and let me ask you, what do you think, how does this play out for the Republican Party in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts over first the next several days as we approach inauguration and then in the aftermath?
Well, I think it plays out, you know, in ways that are similar to the ways it plays out across the country. And I think it's a real interesting time of reckoning for the Republican Party. I mean, I was struck today, for example, by a letter from 22 former Republican lawmakers who are advocating for impeaching President Trump. And those include a former Republican congressman from Massachusetts, Peter Torkelson, Peter Smith from Vermont, Claudine Schneider from Rhode Island, and former U.S. Senator Gordon Humphrey from New Hampshire. So I really think that the Republican Party, both in Massachusetts and across the country, is going through a kind of split about how to deal with this. And you see it happening in the Senate. The numbers are small, but you've got people like Pat Toomey and Lisa Murkowski and Ben Sasse who basically say they're open to the idea of impeachment, if not some other way to remove President Trump from office. But very few other Republicans so far in the Senate have signed up for that. But I think you're going to see this playing out across the country and indeed in Massachusetts about how, you know, where. I'll give you one more example. Jennifer Horne, the former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party and one of the co-founders of the Lincoln Project, which has been working very hard on public on advertising spots to get to defeat Donald Trump. She resigned. She has given up her membership in the Republican Party because she just says there is no credible way for the Republican Party to go forward and represent Democratic values if they don't distance themselves from what happened last week and President Trump in particular.
And Judge Gertner, following that back to Washington, there's also been a number of questions about the fate of some of the Republican senators, in particular Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, others in the House who carried forward the challenge to certifying the election last Wednesday in the context of this insurrection. Anything we might likely see there, and what are the legal avenues?
Well, they clearly are entitled legally to say what they said. The consequences are political, more not legal with respect to them. But you have to, the building blocks of what happened in the Capitol was the fight about the electoral votes initially, of the notion that there was, this was a fraudulent election, and all the Republicans who participated in that obviously used exactly the same language. Then there were people who said, that's going on and we have to do something about it. And what was the doing something about it? And how far did they go to do something about it? With respect to the senators, what they were doing, though in my view preposterous, was within the scope of their job. What Trump was doing was a horse of a different color. What he was doing in terms of calling, you know, the Georgia investigator, the Georgia electoral officials, the U.S. attorney, that begins to cross over. We talk about sedition in terms of what he was saying that day, but I think that you have to broaden this and look at what he had been doing all along, which really was an attempt to illegally interfere with the government of the United States. That's not Hawley and Cruz, but I think it's President Trump.
All right. On that note, we'll have to end. That's Judge Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst, as well as WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Hey, thanks to both of you. I appreciate you coming back this week and continuing to sort through this with us.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure.